You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Reading Radio Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading for the Council Bluff Daily's Nonpareil for Wednesday, May 1st. I'm Elena Hines from Drake University, and here's our first story. The first story is titled, Walmart to Close Health Centers, written by Michelle Chapman of the Associated Press. Walmart will close its health centers and virtual care service after struggling to find success with the offerings, the U.S. retailer said Tuesday. The Bentonville, Arkansas-based company said that after managing the clinics it's launched in 2019 and expanding its telehealth program, it concluded, there is not a sustainable business model for us to continue. Walmart had 51 health centers in 5 states with the goal of helping people save money on their healthcare needs. This is a difficult decision, and like others, the challenging reimbursement environment and escalating operating costs create a lack of profitability that make the care business unsustainable for us at this time, the company said in a statement. A spokeswoman said reimbursement proved challenging from all types of insurance. The planned closure of the Walmart Health Center comes after the company announced in March 2023 that it planned to add more than 24 health centers to some of its stores this year. At the time, the company said it was looking to open 28 centers in 2024, mostly in Dallas and Houston. It also planned to expand into the Phoenix and Kansas City, Missouri areas. Walmart is among several retailers that sought to build a presence with medical clinics and make healthcare more accessible, but some struggled. Walgreens spent more than $5 billion a few years ago to acquire a majority stake in VillageMD and planned to add hundreds of clinics to its stores. In late March, the company announced the closure of its 140 of its VillageMD primary care clinics and plans to shutter 20 more to boost profitability. The announcement came after Walgreens recorded a $5.8 billion after-tax impairment charge for VillageMD in its most recent quarter as it adjusted the asset's value. Though the United States has a shortage of primary care doctors, building a network of primary care clinics can be challenging, even for established companies, according to healthcare researchers and analysis. Many people who already have a doctor may be reluctant to leave, and some may not want to get care in a store or retail setting. Clinics may also have to spend a lot of money to treat and improve the health of new patients who haven't been seeing a doctor. Walmart did not yet have specific dates for when its health centers will close, but said that it will share that information when it's available. The company said employees that worked at its health centers are eligible to transfer to any of the other Walmart or Sam's Club location. Walmart still runs about 4,600 pharmacies and more than 3,000 vision centers in the United States. The next story that I'll be reading is titled, Friday's Tornadoes Strongest in Decade, National Weather Service, Minden Tornadoes, an EF3, written by Julie Anderson of Omaha World Health. At the top of the article, there is an image showing a neighborhood from the small town of Minden from the drone's perspective of just the little neighborhood. The image of splintered homes and farms leaves little doubt about the ferocity of the tornado-spawning storms that battered western Iowa and eastern Nebraska on Friday. But new information released Monday by the National Weather Service's Omaha office in Valley, Nebraska, indicates that there were the most powerful storms to hit the area in the past 10 years. In its preliminary assessment, the office had tallied 10 tornadoes within its coverage area, 5 rated an EF3 on the enhanced Fujita scale, 2 rated an EF2, and 3 listed an EF1. The EF3 tornadoes, which pack winds of 136 miles per hour to 165 miles per hour, are the strongest to strike the area since an EF3 landed near Coleridge, Nebraska, on June 17, 2014, according to the report. That storm struck a day after 4 EF4 tornadoes tore through northeast Nebraska, including the twin EF4 twisters that hit Pillar, Nebraska on June 16, 2004. We haven't seen tornadoes as strong in our area for a decade, said Brennan Dara, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service office. In a press conference, Nebraska Governor Jim Pillen said 4 hangars that were destroyed at Omaha's Epley Airfield will cost $1.5 million each to replace. Restoring electricity and fixing damage to electrical infrastructure will likely top $6 million. Other costs, including clearing roadways of debris, law enforcement officials have been providing security in damaged neighborhoods. To help assess damage, officials said that the Federal Emergency Management Agency has contracted for Civil Air Patrol to conduct imaging flights over the tornado's path. This section's titled Tornadoes Tally will certainly go up. In its assessment of the storm's power, the Weather Service said crews have surveyed all of the stronger tornadoes that struck the region, but DARA said the agency is still working to assess smaller ones. The total number of tornadoes will certainly go up, said DARA, who called the event one for the record books. Additionally, tornadoes were recorded in central Iowa and Missouri, DARA said. The tornadoes of the Omaha office surveyed combined a total track length of 162.5 miles and were on the ground for a total of 4 hours and 51 minutes, according to the Omaha's office report. The maximum wind speed, based on ground-level damage assessments, was 165 miles per hour. The maximum single tornado track length was 40.9 miles. Two tornadoes were up to a mile wide at some point. The tornadoes respond by storms known as supercells, which go through cycles. They can strengthen and spin out a tornado, then weaken and later form again to produce more, DARA said. One storm produced an EF3 tornado that developed just east of the Epley Airfield runway, destroying several aircraft hangars and aircraft, and then crossed the river and damaged homes south of the Crescent. It continued northeast and dissipated in a field just north of the Harrison-Pottawatomie County line. A third storm produced two EF3 tornadoes, one that started in southeast Iowa and came within a mile or two of McLead, and another that struck Minden before tracking as far as Harlan and Defiance, cutting a path nearly 41 miles long. At the National Weather Service, the meteorologist wrote, "Our hearts are with all of those impacted, including our friends, our neighbors, and everyone who has been affected by these devastating tornadoes." This part of the story is titled, "Severe Storm Leaves Water Concern." The Douglas County Health Department issued a press release Monday to remind people whose homes are supplied by wells that Friday's storm may have left them with some specific issues. If you live in one of these homes, you need to make sure debris did not damage your wellhead before you use the water from that well, the release said. A damaged or even cracked wellhead can be a point for contamination from the rain. If your wellhead is damaged, it should be inspected and repaired by a qualified well repair service. The department also advised residents to check all house power lines for damage before reconnecting to a home. A well pump can be turned off at the breaker if the power needs to be used if the well or house supply lines are compromised. If flooding occurred over the wellhead, your home water should be tested before it is consumed. If flooding has occurred around the septic tank system, please give a day or two for the ground to recover before using a lot of water in the home, the release said. Debris can become a place for disease-carrying vermin. Dispose of all debris as soon as possible without letting it pile up for too long periods of time. Anyone with questions is asked to call the department's sanitation line at 402-444-7481. Martha Stoddard and Kevin Cole of the Omaha World Health contributed to this report. The next story is titled, "Volunteers Pick Up Debris as Officials Ask for Money," written by Christopher Burback and Kevin Cole of the Omaha World Herald. At the top of this story, there's an image showing three men picking up debris after one of the tornadoes. Throughout western Iowa and eastern Nebraska, both volunteers and paid workers continue to clean up after Friday's storms. So many people have been willing to help that in some cases, officials have urged the public to back off. Authorities in Pottawatomie County asked that no groups or individuals travel to Minden to help with recovery efforts unless they have received prior approval. A tornado that hit Minden destroyed about 80 houses, including the home of Nicholas Ring, 63, who died Saturday at an Omaha hospital from his injuries. A town of about 600 people in the northern part of the county, Minden, remains closed to the general public due to the amount of significant debris and operation of heavy equipment. One of the current challenges facing response and recovery efforts is the influx of resources that haven't been requested, the county said in a news release. Current reports Current response efforts include provisions for meal availability, water, hydration, medical support, and operational tools. Heavy equipment and resource sufficient for coming week's operations. This section is titled How to Donate. Instead, Pottawatomie County officials said they strongly encourage people to make monetary donations. This will allow the ability to purchase goods that match the needs identified by disaster survivors seeking assistance. Donations can be made to the Southwest Iowa Emergency Relief Fund to support areas impacted throughout the region at givewesterniowa.org. If you wish to have your donation designated to Minden, a special fund is being established by the foundation. This section of the article is titled, Help Show What Community Really Means. At Elkhorn's Greenbrier Park on Monday, Tim Anderson said he was glad to be part of the effort. He recalled that he had wanted to help with the cleanup after Omaha's notorious 1975 tornado, but he was just 14 at the time and his father wouldn't let him, so he had extra motivation to help out at this time. We're just helping out, just doing what we can do to help our neighbors, said Anderson, whose own Elkhorn area home escaped damage Friday. As Anderson, Russ, Wilt tossed branches with help from the City of Omaha worker, Nick Flynn, they marveled at how many volunteers were working over the weekend. There would be like 40 people in a line carrying stuff and tossing it in a pile to be hauled away, Wilt said. Omaha Mayor Gene Stothart lauded at the myriad volunteers as well as first responders and other city workers. It just really shows what community really means, she said. It's people coming together and helping each other. So many volunteers were out there. In fact, in some areas, there were more volunteers than we really knew what to do with. James Johnson and his son, Braylon, backed up their pickup truck with a load of tree debris from their neighborhood, Arbor Ridge, and nearby Ramblewood. It's great that people are pulling together, James Johnson said. You just come together in a community, he said. That's what we do in the Midwest. That's what we're known for. Martha Stoddard from the Omaha World Herald contributed to this report. The next article is titled, Students Occupy School Building. Columbia authorizes police to enter grounds and end protest at Hall. This is written by Cedar Atensanio, Jake Offenhartz, and Jonathan Matisse of the Associated Press. The image for this article shows a student protester parading around a Palestinian flag Tuesday outside of the entrance to Hamilton Hall on the campus of Columbia University campus demonstrations. Police took protesters into custody late Tuesday after Columbia University called into the police to end the pro-Palestinian occupation of the New York campus. The scene unfolded shortly after 9 p.m. as officers wearing helmets and carrying zip ties and riot shields masked at the Ivy League University entrance. Officers breached Hamilton Hall, an administration building on campus, to clear out the structure. The demonstration had occupied the building more than 12 hours earlier, spreading their reach from the encampment elsewhere on the grounds that's been there for nearly 2 weeks. Students defiantly set up tents against the police, cleared an encampment at the university April 18th, and arrested more than 100 people. The students were protesting on the Manhattan campus since the prior day, opposing Israeli military action in Gaza and demanding the school divest from companies they claim are profiting from the conflict. Protests spread to campuses from California to Massachusetts as May commencement ceremonies near, putting added pressure on schools to clear protesters. Other colleges have sought to negotiate agreements with the demonstrators in hopes of having peaceful commencement ceremonies. On Columbia's campus, protesters locked arms early Tuesday and carried furniture and metal barricades to Hamilton Hall, which was among several buildings that were occupied during a 1968 civil rights and anti-Vietnam War protest. Demonstrators called the building Hindles Hall, honoring a young girl who was killed in Gaza under Israeli fire. Israel and its supporters branded the university's protest as anti-Semitic, while Israel critics say it uses those allegations to silence opposition. Though some protesters were caught on camera making anti-Semitic remarks or violent threats. Organizers of the protest, some of who are Jewish, say it's a peaceful movement aiming to defend Palestinian rights and protesting the war. Meanwhile, House Republican on Tuesday announced an investigation into federal funding for universities where students protested. Several House committees will be tasked with a probe that threatens to withhold government supports to the university. The next article is titled, Judge Threatens Jail Time. Court holds the former president in contempt for violating gag order. Written by Michael R. Sisk, Jennifer Peltz, Jake Offenhartz, and Colleen Long of the Associated Press. Trump hush money criminal trial. Donald Trump was held in contempt of court Tuesday and fined $9,000 for reportedly violating a gag order that barred him from making public statements about witnesses, jurors, and some other connected to his New York hush money case. If he does it again, the judge warned, he could be jailed. Prosecutors alleged 10 violations, but New York Judge Juan M. Merchan found there were 9. It was a stinging rebuke of the Republican former president's insistence that he was exercising his free speech rights and a reminder that he's a criminal defendant subject to the harsh realities of trial procedure. This gag order is totally unconstitutional, Trump said as court adjourned. Merchan wrote that he is keenly aware of and protective of Trump's First Amendment rights, particularly given his candidacy for the office of President of the United States. Still, he warned that the court would not tolerate willful violations of a lawful orders and that if necessary and appropriate under the circumstances, it will impose an incarceratory punishment. Tuesday's ruling came at the start of the second week of testimony in the historic case in which Manhattan prosecutors argued Trump and his associates took part in an illegal scheme to influence the 2016 presidential campaign by purchasing and buying seamy stories. The payouts went to a doorman with a torrid yarn, ex-Playboy model Karen McDowell, who had accusations of an affair, and to porn performer Stormy Daniels, who alleged a sexual encounter with Trump. He pleaded not guilty and said the stories were all fake. The judge also announced he will halt the trial on May 17th to allow Trump to attend his son's Barron's High School graduation. In other development, testimony resumed Tuesday with Gary Farrow, a banker who helped former Trump attorney Michael Cohen open accounts, including the one that Cohen used to buy Daniel's silence. Jurors also began hearing from Keith Davison, a lawyer who represented McDowell and Daniels in their negotiations with the National Enquirer and Cohen. He testified that he arranged a meeting at his Los Angeles office to see whether the tabloid's parent company was interested in McDowell's story. The tabloid eventually bought the story. Even as the deal was signed, Davidson testified that he understood McDowell's story would never be published. The next article is titled, Deaths Bring Changes Ahead of Race. Horse Racing, the 150th Kentucky Derby, written by Beth Harris of the Associated Press. The image tied to this article is of a man hugging a horse, and it says, Uncle Lino is comforted after an injury during 141st Preakness Stakes horse race on May 21st, 2016 at Pimlico Race Course in Baltimore. Memories are made at the Kentucky Derby. Most of them are good. Whether cashing a winning ticket, sipping mint juleps, or marveling at the horses, crowds pack Churchill Downs to experience a bucket list sporting event. Many left last year in tears, anger, and questioning the safety of the sport after 12 horses died at the historic track in the days surrounding the race, including 2 on the Derby Day when the racing enjoys its biggest attendance and highest TV rating of the year. You can't ever be too safe when it comes to our sport, 2-time Derby-winning jockey Mike Smith said. Deaths occur at other major racing venues last year, too, and what becomes a tragic theme for the sport. The number of deaths in the United States increasingly slided in 2023 from the year before, according to data tracked by the Equine Injury Database and reported by HISA. HISA said there were 1.32 deaths per 1,000 starts last year, up from 1.25 the previous year. The number at the 50 HISA-accredited tracks were 1.23 per 1,000, compared with 1.63 at others across the country. We're encouraged by that progress, said Lisa Lazarus, CEO of HISA, but we certainly have a whole lot more work to do. A review of 14 horse deaths at Saratoga in upstate New York last summer found no definite cause for why they happened, although heavy rainfall could have contributed. Investigations by Churchill Downs and the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act, HISA, the sport's new governing body, didn't identify one common cause for deaths around the Derby. When we say there's not one singular factor that caused the breakdowns, it doesn't mean that we don't know what the risk factors are that contribute to the breakdowns, Lazarus said. Those are things that we've been working on very hard. The deaths prompted Churchill Downs to make several changes to its safety program ahead of the 150th Derby on Saturday. The track upgraded equipment used to harrow and grade the dirt surface with increased testing to measure safety and consistency. The cushion is measured in spots around the track, and moisture content is checked throughout racing days to decide the watering schedule. The track is a lot different than it was. It's got more sand in it now. It's got more base, more cushion, said 88-year-old Hall of Fame trainer D. Wayne Lucas, who saddled Just Steel in the Derby. It's quite a bit deeper. Horses are getting over it good. Hall of Fame trainer Bill Mott, who has resilience in the Derby, likes Churchill dirt strip when it's dry. There's a 40% chance of rain on Derby Day. I don't like it as much when it's wet, he said. It does not handle water as well as it used to, probably because of a lack of sand in it. Hopefully we get a good normal conditions, and I think we're looking at a good racetrack. The New York Racing Association, which runs the Belmont Stakes Racing third leg of the Triple Crown, is studying the feasibility of adopting all-weather surfaces at tracks nationwide. Churchill Downs added an equine safety and integrity veterinarian to help enforce its rules. 15 vets from the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission joined the track's vet team to observe horses this week before, during, and after training, and in their stalls after they arrive. A new safety management committee comprised of trainers, exercise riders, jockeys, track management, and vets meet weekly to discuss the concerns and provide feedback on areas for improvement. All horses racing at the Churchill Downs wear stride-safe biometric sensors that detect changes in their gaits to help spot inconsistencies or early signs of a potential developing injury. The track installed a PET unit for diagnostic imaging. Only the sound such machine permanently located at a U.S. racetrack. Realizing the effect last year's deaths had on the public, the National Thoroughbred Racing Association has launched a national advertising campaign called Safety Runs First to explain what the industry is doing to improve equine safety. NTRA President and CEO Tom Rooney points to HISA as well as investments in the diagnostic technologies, advanced data analytics, and veterinary track surface protocols as a testament to our collective dedication to enhancing safety practices within the industry. HISA took effect in July 2022 to implement national standards for safety at racetracks, replacing the patchwork rules of the 38 racing states and anti-doping and medication control program didn't start until late May 2023, after last year's Derby in Preakness, where one of the trainers, Bob Baffron's horses, was injured in a race and was euthanized. Training Safe Joseph Jr. was suspended and had his Derby horse scratched ahead of last year's race after the sudden deaths of two of his horses at Churchill Downs. He was reinstated when an investigation showed no. The next story is titled, Drug Agency Intends to Reclassify Marijuana. Sources say the move would place cannabis at a lower designation, written by the Associated Press. Washington, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, will move to reclassify marijuana as a less dangerous drug. The Associated Press learned a historic shift to generations of American drug policy that could have wide ripple effects across the country. The DEA's proposal, which still must be reviewed by the White House Office of Management and Budget, would recognize the medical uses of cannabis and acknowledge it has less potential for abuse than some of the nation's most dangerous drugs. It would not federally legalize marijuana for recreational use. The agency's move, confirmed to the AP on Tuesday by five people familiar with the matter who spoke on the condition of the anomaly, clears the least significant regulatory hurdle before the agency's biggest policy change in more than 50 years can take. Once OMB signs off, the DEA will move marijuana from its current classifications as a Schedule 1 drug alongside heroin and LSD. It moves pot to Schedule 3 alongside ketamine and some anabolic steroids following a recommendation from the Federal Health and Human Service Department. The next article is titled, Netanyahu Promises to Invade Rafah, Deal or No Deal. Ceasefire talks with Hamas appeared to pick up some momentum by the Associated Press. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu pledged Tuesday to launch an incursion into the southern Gaza city of Rafah, where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians are sheltering from the almost seven-month-long war, just as ceasefire negotiations between Israel and Hamas militants appear to be gaining steam. Netanyahu's comments came hours before the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was to arrive in Israel to advance the truce talks, which appeared to be one of the most serious rounds of negotiations between Israel and Hamas since the war began. The deal is meant to free hostages, bring some relief to the population, and avert the Israelis' offensive into Rafah and the potential harm to the civilians there. The U.S. has repeatedly said it opposes the Rafah operation until Israel presents a credible plan for evacuating and protecting the estimated 1.5 million people seeking shelter there. Meanwhile, the UN International Court of Justice rejected a request Tuesday by Nicaragua to order Germany to halt military and other aid to Israel and renew funding to the UN aid and agency in Gaza. The next article is titled, Regulators Challenge More Patents on Drugs. There is no author listed for this article. Federal regulators are challenging patents on 20 brand-name drugs, including the blockbuster weight loss injection Ozempic, and another Biden administration action targeting industry practices that drive up pharmaceutical prices. The Federal Trade Commission sent warning letters to 10 drug makers Tuesday, taking issue with patents on popular drugs for weight loss, diabetes, asthma, and other conditions. The letters allege certain patents filled by Novo Nordiscus, GlaxoSmithKline, AstraZeneca, and seven other companies are inaccurate or misleading. Drug makers use patents to starve off cheaper generic medications by filling bogus patent listings. Pharma companies block competition and inflate the cost of prescription drugs, forcing Americans to pay sky-high prices for medications they rely on, FTC Chair Lina Khan said in a statement. You're listening to Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, May 1st on IRIS, the Iowa Reading Radio Information System for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Elena Hines from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. We have now moved to the sports session of today's reading. And the first article we have here is titled, Deaths Bring Changes Ahead of Race, Horse Racing, the 150th Kentucky Derby, written by Beth Harris of the Associated Press. Pictured here is a man hugging a horse, and it says, Uncle Lino is comforted after an injury during the 141st Preakness Stakes horse race on May 21st, 2016 at Pimlico Race Course in Baltimore. Memories are made at the Kentucky Derby, most of them good. Whether cashing a winning ticket, sipping mint and tulips, or marveling at the horses, crowds packed Churchill Downs to experience a bucket list sporting event. Many left last year in tears, anger, and questioning the safety of sport after 12 horses died at the historic track in the days surrounding the race, including two on Derby Day when racing enjoys its biggest attendance and highest TV ratings of the year. You can't ever be too safe when it comes to our sport, two-time Derby-winning jockey Mike Smith said. Deaths occurred at other major racing venues last year, too, in what became a tragic theme for the sport. The number of deaths in the United States increased slightly in 2023 from the year before. According to data tracked by the Equine Injury Database and reported by the HISA, HISA said there were 1.32 deaths per 1,000 starts last year, up from 1.25 the previous year. The number at the 50 HISA accredited tracks was 1.23 per 1,000, compared with 1.63 at others across the country. We're encouraged by that progress, said Lisa Lazarus, CEO of HISA, but we certainly have a whole lot more work to do. A review of 14 horse deaths at Saratoga in upstate New York last summer found no definite cause for why they happened, although heavy rainfall could have contributed. Investigations by Churchill Downs and the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act, HISA, the sport's new governing body, didn't identify one common cause for the deaths around the Derby. When we say there's not one singular factor that caused the breakdowns, it doesn't mean that we don't know what risk factors are that contribute to breakdowns, Lazarus said. Those are things that we've been working on very hard. The deaths prompted Churchill Downs to make several changes to his safety programs ahead of the 150th Derby on Saturday. The track upgraded equipment to use to harrow the grade and dirt surface, with increasing testing to measure safety and consistency. The cushion is measured in spots around the track, and moisture content is checked throughout racing days to decide the watering schedule. The track is a lot different than it was. It's got more sand in it now. It's got more base, more cushion, said 88-year-old Hall of Fame trainer Dwayne Lucas, who saddles Just Steel in the Derby. It's quite a bit deeper. Horses are getting over it good. Hall of Fame trainer Bill Mott, who had resilience in the Derby, likes Churchill's dirt strip when it's dry. There's a 40% chance of rain on Derby Day. I don't like it as much when it's wet, he said. It does not handle water as well as it used to, probably because of a lack of sand on it. Hopefully we get good, normal conditions, and I think we're looking at a good racetrack. The New York Racing Association, which runs the Belmont Stakes Racing's third leg of the Triple Crown, is studying the feasibility of adopting all-weather surface at tracks nationwide. Churchill Downs added an equine safety and integrity veterinarian to help enforce its rules. 15 vets from the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission joined the track's vet team to observe horses this week before, during, and after training, and in their stalls after they arrive. A new safety management committee comprised of trainers, exercise riders, jockeys, track management, and vets meets weekly to discuss concerns and provide feedback on areas for improvement. All horses racing at Churchill Downs wear stride-safe biometric sensors that detect changes in their gaits to help spot inconsistencies or early signs of potential developing injury. The track installed a PET unit for diagnostic imaging, only the second such machine permanently located in the United States racetrack. Realizing the effect last year's death had on the public, the National Thoroughbred Racing Association has launched a national advertising campaign called Safety Runs First to explain what the industry is doing to improve equine safety. NTRA President and CEO Tom Rooney points to HISA, as well as investments in the diagnostic technology, advanced data analytics, and veterinary and track surface protocols as a testament to our collective dedication to enhancing safer practices within the industry. HISA took effect in July 2022 to implement national standards for safety at racetracks, replacing the patchwork rules of the 38 racing states. Its anti-doping and medication control program didn't start until late May 2023 after last year's Derby in Preakness, where one of trainer Bob Baffert's horses was injured in a race and was euthanized. Trainer Safi Joseph Jr. was suspended and had his Derby horse scratched ahead of last year's race after the sudden deaths of two of his horses at Churchill Downs. He was reinstated when an investigation showed no wrongdoing on his part. It proved that we handled things correctly, he said. Why did it happen? We don't know. We didn't have answers. It knocks you down and it's something you carry with you the rest of your life. We're thankful to be back. Joseph Osado long shot Cadillac on Saturday. HISA has been dodging the legal challenges from groups of horsemen opposing the new rules and frustration from those eager for national uniform rules in the sport. Still, many see progress being made even as it comes and fits and starts. It's been a little bit sloppy and all over the place, two-time Derby winning trainer Doug O'Neill said, but I do think the sport has evolved into a safer spot. Smith, who isn't participating Saturday but has ridden in a record 28 derbies, has adjusted to the additional scrutiny. It's a wonderful, beautiful, beautiful game, but it can also be very dangerous, he said. We certainly need all of these protocols. The next sports story is titled, Maxey, 76ers avoid ouster defeat, Knicks in overtime. By the NBA Associated Press. The image for this article is Tyrese Maxey in the center and is shooting over the Knicks' OG Anunoby and Mitchell Robinson during the first half of the Tuesday's playoff game in New York. Tyrese Maxey saved Philadelphia from elimination with 7 points in the final, 25 seconds of regulation, finished with 46 and led the 76ers to a 112-106 overtime victory over the New York Knicks on a Tuesday night in Game 5 of their first-round series. The Sixers trailed by 6 points with 28 seconds left in regulation before Maxey pulled out a comeback that evoked memories of Reggie Miller's 8 points and 9 seconds for Indiana at Madison Square Garden in 1995. The All-Star guard converted a 4-point play with 25 seconds remaining to cut it to 2 after Josh Hart's free throw pulled up from 35 feet to tie it at 97 with 8.1 seconds left in the front of a stunned crowd that was set to celebrate the Knicks' second straight trip to the Eastern Conference semifinals. Joel Embiid finished with 19 points, 16 rebounds, and 10 assists for the Sixers, who will host Game 6 on Thursday night. Bucks 115, Pacers 92. Chris Middleton and Bobby Portis each scored 29 points, and shorthanded Milwaukee kept its season alive by routing Indiana at home. Portis had the highest points total of his playoff career and added 10 rebounds to make amends two nights after he got ejected from a Game 4 loss. Middleton had his third straight game with at least 25 points, and he also contributed 12 rebounds and 5 assists. The Pacers still lead the best of seven series 3-2, heading into Game 6 on Thursday in Indianapolis. The Pacers are trying to advance beyond the opening round for this first time since 2014. Milwaukee, which has never won a series and which it 3-1, made sure the Pacers wouldn't clinch anything Tuesday. Cavaliers 104, Magic 103. Donovan Mitchell scored 28 points. Evan Mobley blocked Franz Wagner's layup in the final seconds, and host Cleveland survived a scare from Orlando, holding off Pablo Banchero and the Magic to take a 3-2 series lead. The Cavs, who were embarrassed by the Magic while dropping two games in Orlando last week, regrouped inside Roaring Rocket Mortgage Field House. It took everything they had after Mitchell missed a jumper with 15.7 seconds left. Wagner drove from the left side with the potential game-tying layup, but was denied at the rim with 6 seconds left by Mobley, who smacked the ball off of the backboard. We are now moving to the lifestyle section of the newspaper, and the first article that I'm going to read is titled, "Well, That's Another Fine Mess, Humor," by Jeremy Zazima, Tribune News Service. And the image for this article is just a bunch of books and papers and boxes all kind of just stacked on top of each other in this messy office. If the remains of Jimmy Hoffa are ever found, ending a nearly half-century search for the notorious union boss, I know just where they will be. My office. That's because I'm in the middle of one of the biggest cleanups of all time, one that not only rivals the most ambitious urban renewal projects ever undertaken, but could be the basis for an episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I am not a scientist, which is a blessing to humanity because I almost blew up my chemistry lab in high school, but I do know about the law of physics, which states that any space except the one between my ears will be filled. That perfectly describes my office, where I routinely contribute to the decline of the newspaper industry by writing drivel like this. I am cleaning up on orders from my wife, Sue, who is neater and more organized than I am. If we ever won the lottery, we would never collect the money because either Sue would inadvertently throw out the ticket or I would put it in my office for safekeeping and never find it. In fact, it's even worse than the bedroom once used to be by our younger daughter. One summer, when she was home from college, Sue described the room as a disaster area. Because I think differently from most people, fortunately for the most people, I decide to see if I have been the bedroom official declared a disaster area, so we would be eligible for state or federal funds to clean it up. I called the New York Disaster Preparedness Commission, described the hellhole that and was told that it was too big a job for the state that I would have to go to federal. So this is absolutely true. I called the White House to see if President George W. Bush, who was in office at the time, has had two daughters about the same ages as my two daughters, had ever declared his rooms disaster areas. I reached First Lady Laura Bush's press secretary, who said, and I quote, that would be classified information. My daughter responded by putting a lock on her bedroom door. That's what I would do with my office door, except I am neither as smart nor as handy as she is. So I have begun a massive cleanup that includes getting rid of countless books, not any of the seven I have written, though. Lord knows some people think they should be in a landfill, and reams of paper. I must have more paper, including almost 40 years worth of newspaper columns, than National Archives. I have so far donated more than 100 books to my local library, including textbooks from high school and college that I never read. It's wonderful. It's a wonder I graduated. During the most recent of our newer ending home improvement projects, we had a dumpster in the driveway. I took advantage of it by unloading tons of stuff that at one time seemed important but clearly were dispensable. Slowly but surely, there's light at the end of the tunnel. I'm afraid that a locomotive is in there too. But the cleanup isn't over. I am taking a break because I am at a point of exhaustion. Yes, I know that a cluttered office is a sign of sick, disorganized mind. On the other hand, a pristine office is the sign of a sick, compulsive mind. Either way, I can't win. Still, I'm hoping to find Jimmy Hoff. It would be like winning the lottery. Jerry Zizima writes a humor column for the Tribune News section and is the author of 6 books. His latest is One for the Ageless, How to Stay Young and Immature Even If You're Really Old. Email jerryz111 at optonline.net. The next article is titled Twinkle Twinkle Exploding Star. NASA predicts rare event will be visible this year even without a telescope. Written by Kayla Simmes, Staten Island Advance. The image for this article is a star that looks like it's bursting with pink and blue colored lines that are coming out of it. If the recent solar eclipse was not enough excitement for stargazers, NASA has reported there will be another rare event. A star system located 3,000 light years away from Earth has been predicted by NASA to become visible to the unaided eye pretty soon. The event is being called a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity as the nova outburst occurs only about every 80 years. The upcoming nova of the T. Coronae Borealis star system last occurred in 1946, and astronomers believed it will do it again sometime in 2024, according to NASA. A nova is a sudden, short-lived brightening of an otherwise inconspicuous star, the space agency reported. Bill Cook of NASA, Meteoroid Environment Office at Alabama Marshall Space Flight Center, told AL.com that the timing of the explosion is much harder to predict than the eclipse, but he said that when it happens, it will be something you remember. NASA reported that once the outburst is at its most intense, it should be visible to the unaided eye for several days in just over a week with binoculars. The celestial event will take place near the Kala Station Coronae Borealis, or the Northern Crown, a small semicircle arc-bearer's boots in Hercules, according to NASA. This is where the outburst will appear as a new, bright star, making this recurring nova one of only 5 in our galaxy. The little note from NASA says, stars are essentially giant fusion reactions occurring in the vacuum of space. Because stars have so much mass, they possess powerful gravitational force, but they don't collapse because of the outward force generated by nuclear fusion, continually converting hydrogen atoms to helium. Sometimes stars begin orbiting each other, forming a binary star system. Typically, this involves a white dwarf star and a red giant orbiting, or the red giant like a moon. The dwarf star rips matter from its companion until it essentially gags on the excess, coughing hot gas and radiation into space. This dramatic phenomenon is relatively common, and the white dwarf is not destroyed in the resulting nova. The next story within the lifestyle section is titled Counting Calories to Shrink Waistlines on Nutrition. The image shown for this article is someone standing on a scale, and they have little sad faces drawn on their feet. My husband and I mysteriously arrived back from our month-long trip to Texas with extra baggage, and it seems to be stuck to our waist. We both had the same excuses. We didn't eat that much, except for a few Lone Star beers, And between riding our horses and dancing to great bands, we got plenty of exercise. Even so, when we get home, we got nasty messages from our scale. I'm a dietitian, so I should know how to solve this problem, right? Convinced that he needed to realize how much he was eating, I suggest we write down everything we eat for a week or so, and I would calculate our calorie intake. What are calories anyways? In a nutshell, one peanut has 5 calories, by the way. A calorie is how we measure the food in the energy in food. Like the gasoline we put in our vehicles, calories provide the fuel that runs these bodies of ours, and calories come from these sources: protein, carbohydrates, sugars and starches, and fats. However, there's one basic flaw in human bodies that I might talk to God about one day. Unlike the gas tank that won't let me put more fuel in my truck than it can hold, my mouth has no automatic shutoff. Our bodies do try to help us out, though. If I fill up with excess calories, my body tucks that energy away for future famine. That's what we brought back with us from Texas, stored energy in the form of not-so-controlled love handles. So what have we learned in the first few days of counting calories? Mostly glaringly, my husband is doing better than I am. In my defense, his body needs more calories due to the fact that he's a man and has a larger body. So if I want those extra jiggles to give up their residence, I have to eat less than he does. Darn. To be clear, we aren't starving ourselves on some nutty diet. We actually are eating the same foods we ate before. The difference is that we are now aware of the 95 calories in every tablespoon of peanut butter we put on our morning toast. We're simply paying more attention to the calories we put in our tanks. Another thing that irks me, but is absolutely true, even though we may have remained active, these older bodies of ours do not need as much calories as we did in our younger years. Yet, they still require as many or more vitamins, minerals, and other nutrients. So as we cut back on calories, we're filling up on foods that pack a lot of nutrients into each bite, such as veggies, fruit, and lower-fat proteins foods. For instance, my husband was thrilled when he learned that he can snack on cherry tomatoes for a mere 25 calories a cup. I'm still learning to ignore the leftover Easter candy. Barbara Entmill is a registered dietitian. Email her at you can email her at Quinn, Q-U-I-N-N, essentialnutrition.com. The next story is titled Sharing the Stage. Music Hell's Kitchen and Play Stereophonic each lead with 13 nods. Written by Mark Kennedy of the Associated Press. And the picture for this article, it is a male and a female. And the people are Malaya Joy Moon Left and Chris Lee Star in Hell's Kitchen, which is nominated for 13 Tonys. This year also marketed for a record for most woman director nominated. Two Broadway shows celebrating the origins of sonic creativity, the music Hell's Kitchen, selected by Alicia Keys Songs, and the play Stereophonic about a 70s rock band at the edge of stardom, each earned a leading 13 Tony Awards nominations, a list that also saw a record number of women nominated for Best Director. A total of 28 shows earned a Tony's nod or more, with the musical The Outsiders, an adaptation of the Best Love S.E. Hinton novel, and the Francis Ford Coppola film, earning 12 nominations, a starry reveal of Cabaret starring Eddie Redmayne, nabbing 9, and appropriate Brandon Jacobs Jenkins, searing play about a family reunion in Arkansas where everyone had competing motivations and grievances, grabbing 8. The nominations marketed a smashing of the Tony record for most woman directors named in a single season. The 2022 Tony Awards had held the record for the most female director nominees, with the 4 total across 2 races, musical and play. Only 10 women have gone on to win a directing crown. This year, there's 3 women were nominated for the best play direction: Lila Neurobarbin, Appropriate, Anne Kaufman, Mary Jane, and Whitney White, Jaja's African Hair Braiding. While 4 were nominated in the musical category: Mariah Friedman, Merrily We Roll Along, Lee Singelman, Suffs, Jessica Strone, Water for Elephants, and Dana Taymor, The Outsiders. The one thing I feel is it's starting to feel less remarkable, which is great news. Stone said after her nomination, "We are directors and not woman directors. I'm noticing it more and more, and that's the wonderful thing to think about. It's a wonderful place to be." Rachel McAdams making her Broadway debut in Mary Jane earned the Best Actress in Play nomination, while Succession star Jeremy Strong got his first nomination for his role in the retrieval of An Enemy of the People, and Liev Schreiber of Ray Donovan Frame nabbed one of the leading doubt. Jessica Lange in Mother Play, Sarah Paulson in Appropriate, and Amy Ryan, who stepped in at the last minute for the Doubt revival, also earned nominations in the Best Actress in Play category. The Big Bang Theory star Jim Parsons earned a supporting nod for Mother Play, and Daniel Radcliffe on his fifth Broadway show. A revival of Stephen Sondheim's Merrily We Roll Along won first nomination. Starry Procedures, who earned Tony nods, including Keys, Angelina Jolie for The Outsiders, and Hillary Rodham Clinton for Stuffs. Lamar Richardson, an actor turned producer, had many reasons to smile after nominations were announced. He helped produce the new revivals of The Wiz, Merrily We Roll Along, and Appropriate. I really think this is Broadway at its best, he said. There's really something for everyone. There's the quintessential big jukebox musical. There's the niche moving three-handed plays. I think that this is really a smorgasbord of what Broadway can offer, and showing it still, of course, is a major player on the art scene, and it's here to stay. The next article I'm going to read is What a TikTok Ban Could Mean for You. Worried about using this app or a workaround? Here's what to know. By the Associated Press. No, TikTok will not suddenly disappear from your phone, nor will you go to jail if you continue using it after it is banned. After years of attempt to ban the Chinese-owned app, including by the former President Donald Trump, a measure that could ban the popular video-sharing app in the U.S. recently won congressional approval, and President Joe Biden signed it April 24th. This measure gives Beijing-based parent company ByteDance 9 months to sell the company, with a possible additional 3 months if a sale is in progress. If it doesn't, TikTok will be banned. So what does this mean for you, a TikTok user, or perhaps the parent of a TikTok user? Here are some quick questions and answers. When does the ban take effect? The original proposal gave ByteDance just 6 months to divest from its U.S. subsidiary negotiations, lengthened it to 9 months. Then, if the sale is already in progress, the company will get another 3 months to complete it. So it would be at least a year before a ban goes into effect. But with likely court challenges, this could stretch even longer, perhaps years. TikTok has seen some success with court challenges in the past, but has never sought to prevent federal legislation from going into effect. What if I already downloaded it? TikTok, which is used by more than 170 million Americans, most likely won't disappear from your phone, even if an actual ban does take effect. But it would disappear from Apple and Google app stores, which means users won't be able to download it. This would also mean that TikTok wouldn't be able to send updates, security patches, and bug fixes, and over time the app would likely become unusable, not to mention a security risk. Are there workarounds? Teenagers are known for circumventing parental controls when it comes to social media, so dodging the U.S. government's ban is certainly not outside of the realm of possibilities. For instance, users could try to mask their location using a VPN or virtual private network, use alternate app stores, or even install a foreign SIM card into their phone. But some tech savvy is required, and it's not clear what will work and what won't. More likely, users will migrate to another platform, such as Instagram, which has TikTok-like feature called Reels, or YouTube, which has incorporated vertical short videos in its feed to try to compete with TikTok. Often, such videos are taken directly from TikTok itself, and popular creators are likely to be found on other platforms as well. Should I be worried about using TikTok? Lawmakers from both parties, as well as law enforcement and intelligence officials, have long expressed concerns that Chinese authorities could force ByteDance to hand over data on the 170 million Americans who use TikTok. The worry stems from a set of Chinese national security laws that compel organizations to assist with intelligence gathering, which ByteDance would likely be subjective to, in other far-reaching ways the country's authoritarian government exercises control. Data privacy experts say, though, that the Chinese government could easily get information on Americans in other ways, including through commercial data brokers that sell or rent personal information. Lawmakers and some administration officials also expressed concerns that China could direct or influence ByteDance to suppress or boost TikTok content favorable to its interests. TikTok, for its part, has deemed assertions it could be used as a tool for the Chinese government. The company also said it has never shared U.S. user data with Chinese authorities and won't do so if asked. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily's Nonpareil for Wednesday, May 1st. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Elena Hines from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.